Hello everyone, I'm lucky enough to be working for a while with an ancient and venerable charity called the British and Foreign Schools Society, and this funds education projects in the UK and across the world to support disadvantaged young people. It just so happens that the BFSS has an interesting history, and so it occurred to me you might be interested in hearing about it and its founder, Joseph Lancaster. Also, we have a very friendly relationship with a museum called the British Schools Museum, who have recently won a grant and are going live with a new exhibition very soon. So what follows is an interview with Andy about Joseph Lancaster, his work in the 19th century on social reform and education, and the history of the British and Foreign Schools Society. To Joseph Lancaster. Now, my guest today, Andy, knows Lancaster's story very well, and he also works both for the BFFS, but also the museum that holds the last remaining Lancasterian schoolroom in the world, which is in glorious Hitchin, known locally as the Golden City, or City of Dreams sometimes. Well, it's not actually, but never mind. So, Andy, hello.
Good morning, David. The City of Dreams.
The City of Dreams. You're actually in the City of Dreams right now.
I am indeed, yes.
Marvellous, yes. Fantastic. Well, you know, give it away from me. So, Andy, you, tell me your title and what you do.
Well, I have the interesting title of Audience Development Manager at the British Schools Museum in Hitchin.
Right.
Which is all about bringing the work of Joseph Lancaster and, by association, the work of the British and Foreign Schools Society to the attention of more and more people, and getting more and more people to visit the museum and spreading the word through podcasts such as this, for example.
Great. Yes, we can kill two small feathered creatures today together by telling everybody about social reform in the 19th century and also telling them about Hitchin. What could be better than that? We're here to talk about Joseph Lancaster then, Andy. I expect very few listening will have ever heard of the lad. So could you start us off with a 30-second overview? Who was Joseph Lancaster and why should we be interested in him?
Certainly, David. Well, if you'd asked me that question 200 years ago, almost everybody in this country would have heard of him. But sadly, you're quite right. Today, he is largely forgotten. He was a young man who emerged from almost complete obscurity and literally went out and changed the world. His ideas about education were not wholly original, but he had a boundless energy and ambition with which he propagated those ideas, and eventually they would spread all across the world. Certainly, he hugely accelerated the cause of public education. He changed people's thinking about the profession of teaching and started a movement which saw schools using his methods set up all across the globe. Sadly, his life went full circle. He died in poverty and obscurity, but it's no exaggeration to say that millions of children across the world owe their first taste of education to Lancaster's amazing vision and energy.
Joseph was born in 1778, I believe. Tell me more about his background.
Well, he was actually the 10th child of quite a poor, lower working class family from Southwark in South London. His father, Richard, had been a soldier, had a small military pension, which he supplemented by making predominantly cane sieves and small items of cane furniture, just from a little workshop in his house in Southwark. Lancaster was quite lucky in a sense because he did have the chance to go to school. His father's business appears to have done quite well. It was something called a dame school, which was really just a little better than babysitting services where a widow or unmarried lady would take children into her home for the day. And for Joseph, this turned out to be quite a good opportunity. But the family were very poor. We know that two of his sisters died in the workhouse. He did come from not the very bottom of a layer of society. They weren't destitute, but not someone who you'd expect to make a great impact on the world.
So when did his sisters die, actually?
Well, in their 30s, actually. So I think it's indicative of the fact that despite the great work he did, that himself or his family never had any personal wealth and remained pretty much strapped throughout their lives.
Interesting. Okay, so set the scene for us. He's going to have a career in education. What was education like at the time that he was a young man?
Well, it was the preserve of the rich, really, David. Most children went out to work from the age of possibly as young as 6 or 7 in the industrial north, in textile factories and down pit, and lots and lots of children working in the agricultural sector, of course. So very few children actually had the opportunity to have any formal education whatsoever unless their family could pay for it. Some, as Joseph did, went to what is called dame schools. As I say, often little more than just babysitting services. But Joseph took his opportunity there at the dame school, and sometimes it was possible to get a rudimentary education. And that's what he did himself. He wrote, "Here I soon learned to read. Books became my meat, my drink, and my diversion." So the dame, in his case, must have been quite an effective teacher, and he went on to do quite remarkable things on a very small, piecemeal kind of education.
In 1798, I think, he then founded a school in Southwark. What was so different about that school, and where had the ideas come from?
After he left the dame school, he started a little second-hand book business, buying and selling second-hand books. And he actually proved himself to be quite a shrewd businessman. He earned enough money to take on a private tutor. So this is where the sort of secondary education, you might call it, began. And then he worked briefly as a master's assistant in two schools in London, where he says he found the teaching on offer so uninspiring and tedious that he felt that he could do better himself. And certainly this is a great trait of Lancaster's, a massive self-confidence. But I suppose if you're going to go out and change the world from
the
origins, you need that drive, don't you?
Yeah, the world's greatest gift, yeah.
Indeed. So he decided he would start a school of his own. Initially, just in one of the rooms of his father's house, where he took six young men in to teach them to read and write at fourpence a week. And his reputation spread very quickly. He was, by all accounts, an absolutely inspirational, enthusiastic teacher. And he did a couple of things which were quite unusual at the time. First of all, he didn't thrash his children. He said once that for those taking their first sip from learning stream, those pleasant draughts should not be embittered by stern-browed severity. Which is a typical sort of Lancasterian, slightly pompous quote, really. But he was a Quaker. He didn't believe in corporal punishment. And there are eyewitness accounts of children running joyfully to his school.
Right, good Lord.
Indeed, just as we all did in our own time, I'm sure.
Is that right? Okay, yeah, of course, yeah.
So I think a combination of... he seems to have had some... some of his ideas were quite derivative, but others were quite unusual at the time. So the idea that children ought to be stimulated, they ought to be motivated and rewarded rather than being beaten, led to some very effective and very successful provision of schooling, which soon began to expand quite rapidly, so that he had hundreds of children coming to the school, where he clearly had to take on a larger premises. From that point onwards, really, it's a short period of incredibly fast growth. Hundreds of children coming to the schools, and he then begins to develop methods by which a single teacher could teach several hundred children all in one space. Primarily due to financial restrictions, he couldn't afford initially to pay a second master. So he developed something which became known as the monitorial system of education.
Right.
And for this, he did draw on the work of a gentleman called Dr. Andrew Bell, who'd been working in Madras, as it was then, Chennai, I believe now. And he developed something called the Madras Method, which was really just using older boys to teach younger boys. So the master taught the monitors, and the monitors taught the children. And by this method, Lancaster once, as you would often do, proudly boasted that one master could teach 1,000 boys in one room with the aid of two books. Try not to let that one get out too widely, just in case any current Secretary of State for Education...
Right, okay, I think this is a good idea, yeah. Yeah, let's get those to ourselves. We don't want the monitorial system back now, revolutionary though it was at the time. So one of the these children are paying now, are they?
Some are, some aren't. So if you recall, I mentioned that Lancaster's first little business enterprise, the little second-hand book business, he demonstrated some quite shrewd business skills there and made quite a steady profit from it. This was a bit of a flash in the pan. So his business plan... for his school can be summed up really by the sign that he had made and put above the front door, which said, "All who will may bring their children and have them educated freely. And those who do not wish to have education for nothing may pay for it if they please." And it is part of Lancaster's charm in a way that he rather naively thought that because the work he was doing was very worthy, very praiseworthy, that people would pay, the rich would pay and the poor would benefit. Of course they didn't.
Oops.
And he had financial troubles throughout his career, really.
Right, but he's got a system here where he can, at very least, the monitorial system allows him to deliver education to those who haven't been able to have it before, either very cheaply or indeed free.
Yes.
Yeah, which is something of an innovation. And then in 1803, everything's going viral, he then published a book, is that right? Improvements in Education. How was that book received?
Well, in many quarters, it was received very well. It sold very well. Lancaster produced a number of books and pamphlets during his life, all sold by subscription to make money for his society. And the combination of the book and the fame of his school, which had become rather a bit of a spectator sport to go along and watch this extraordinary young man with his...
Oh, is that right? People went and had a look?
They did, yes.
God,
many people would go along to the school and marvel at this new methodology and Lancaster's the great enthusiasm and joy that he brought to teaching and to his scholars. So eventually, or fairly quickly actually, it came to the notice of King George III, no less, and he invited him to call in him at Weymouth, where he was taking the sea air. King George said, "It is my wish that all poor children in my dominions should be taught to be able to read the Bible." And he gave Lancaster £100 a year to continue his work.
Right, which is a reasonably substantial amount of cash back then.
It was at that time, and he actually persuaded, perhaps I'm not sure whether that's quite the right word, but Queen Charlotte and five of the royal princesses were persuaded to make a contribution as well. So in total, he was getting about £250 royal patronage, which would be about £23,000 today.
Okay.
And also many nobles and successful businessmen, and even quite modest traders were persuaded to give money to Lancaster Society. He must have been an incredibly persuasive speaker and a persuasive man, because he was actually able to garner quite a lot of subscriptions, both from his writings and from his public speaking.
Great. So his ideas are spreading. What impression did he make on people back then?
I think we could describe him very much as a Marmite character.
People hated him then. Because nobody can like Marmite, obviously, it being engine oil.
I must take issue with you there, David.
Okay, so you either loved him or hate him.
So, yeah, I mean, he inspired enormous loyalty and generosity in many, many people. But he did rub people up the wrong way as well. And I think there were three principal reasons for this. One, he was effectively a jumped-up street urchin. Two, he was a Quaker at a time when the Church of England certainly held sway, and a lot of people felt that it was quite dangerous that this man was, I mean, by this stage, thousands of children going to schools run by a Quaker, not run by the Church of England, which was quite controversial. And the other reason was that, particularly after he had the royal patronage, he did become rather rather cocky, rather arrogant, rather stubborn, and didn't take well to criticism at all, shall we say. So he did embroil himself in a number of sort of quite public spats with people like Dr. Bell, Sarah Trimmer in particular, who was a bit of sort of pillar of the Church of England, a friend of Queen Charlotte. And she'd written quite extensively on education herself and was furious that Lancaster was taking children away from the Church of England's attempt to bring education. He described him as a Goliath for the schismatics.
Right.
Someone trying to sort of create a split in the church. So in his supporters, he was able to inspire almost unending generosity and loyalty. But equally, he did make an awful lot of enemies.
So at the same, you mentioned Sarah Trimmer. So at the same time as Lancaster is spreading these ideas and people are taking them up enthusiastically, in a way that's encouraging and prompting the spread of the national schools as well. Is that right?
Quite right, David, yes. It was written that, I think Robert Southey said that Lancaster had terrified the bishops into action and doubted that they would have done anything serious about education had it not been for the fact that Lancaster was so successful. They felt they ought to do something in competition. So the National School Society, the Church of England Society, was established in 1811.
Right.
Of course, with the great wealth, influence, and resources of the Church of England, the number of national schools quite quickly began to outstrip the number of British schools, as they became known after 1814. I mean, this is another sort of classic Lancasterian sort of situation, really. He finds himself in enormous financial difficulty because he's spending money. Even though he's brilliant at getting money in, he's even better at spending it. So
right.
He spends huge amounts of money on toys, which were used as rewards and motivation for children. He spends an enormous amount of money on food because he writes that starving children cannot concentrate. So he's providing free school meals.
Hmm.
And pre-schooling, sort of a century before the state does so. But of course, he's spending other people's money, and he's spending money he hasn't got. At the very whiff of a new subscription, he'd rush off somewhere and establish a new school.
Right.
So his great friends and supporters, after bailing him out on a number of occasions, eventually they realise he's never going to reform his profligate spending. So the society was reformed in 1814. From that point onwards, it's called the British and Foreign School Society, and all of the schools using Lancasterian methods in this country are known as British schools, which is,
hurrah,
I don't know quite how long we've been talking, but that's why we're called the British Schools Museum.
So problems are emerging with Lancaster's position. His life begins to unravel a little bit, doesn't it? Tell us about his later life and its controversies.
Yeah, sadly, a number of factors conspire to bring enormous stresses and pressures on Lancaster. His wife, Elizabeth, suffered from some quite severe mental health problems and often had to be confined to an asylum, which was a cause of great sadness and stress for Joseph. The financial difficulties don't appear to have unduly worried him. He seems to have been quite blithe about it. He genuinely thought he was doing the Lord's work and the Lord would provide. But the opposition that he faced, you can tell from his letters, which are at times quite hysterical. He didn't react to the criticism very well. Between 1810 and 1814, he goes off on a lecture tour around the country, partly, some people say, to escape his creditors in London. But he gave 67 public lectures to something in the order of 25,000 people.
Gosh.
And established 50 new schools of accommodation for 12,000 scholars on the money.
That's amazing.
Absolutely extraordinary feat of energy and will. But by the time he returns to London, he's physically, mentally, and financially exhausted. And he's greeted by the two major controversies, really. Firstly, one of his former supporters, a gentleman called Francis Place, presents some evidence that Lancaster may not have always practiced what he preached. And there does seem to be some evidence that he may have resorted to corporal punishment on some of his children from time to time. And also, his financial incompetence, really, has led the supporters to reform the Royal Lancasterian Institution as the British and Foreign School Society, and he is offered a relatively junior post within that new society.
Right.
And I think you might guess what his reaction to
yes.
that was.
Not involves fingers and, Agincourt and all that sort of thing.
He went off in a proper strop, really, and
right.
He started to try and found a new society. Some of the funds he used for that probably ought to have stayed with the British and Foreign School Society, but he felt that it was money that he had rightfully gained, and he thought this was a bit of a unfair, hostile takeover, to be honest. But he was rather mischievous for a couple of years in his dealings with his former colleagues.
And he leaves England at some point, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. In June 1818, he sets off, takes ship for New York. And he arrives there in October to a very warm welcome, actually.
Right.
He's feted by the first person who sort of really greets him in a formal sense is the governor of New York State, a man called DeWitt Clinton. And apparently there is a link to Bill Clinton. There's an adoption at some point, so it's not a direct ancestral link.
Mm.
But obviously the Clinton family appears to have been notable politicians over several generations.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really, he's warmly welcomed and invited to speak and feted at various dinners and galas and so forth. And he's a bit of a celeb, which of course he absolutely loves. But unfortunately for Lancaster personally, Lancasterian style schools have already been set up all across North America. His ideas have spread. Many people think they're very sound. What they like are Lancasterian schools. What they don't like is the idea of a rather argumentative, highly strung and financially incompetent man getting involved in the administrations of the school. So he's kind of left a bit of a spare part, really. So in 1824, he's delighted to receive an invitation from Simon Bolivar to go down to South America, where he goes with his daughter, Betsy, and a young teacher he was training called Richard Jones. Mm-hmm. And they attempt to establish schools in Venezuela and Colombia. By this time, he's a nightmare to work with. Fortunately, his time in South America is largely speaking wasted, although the ideas are taken up quite widely. And in fact, there's an interesting legacy of Lancaster's in Mexico. His daughter, Betsy, married Richard Jones, and they went to Mexico, and Richard was quite instrumental in founding Lancasterian schools across Mexico, a country in which this system was probably taken up with more enthusiasm and vigour than anywhere in the world. The family stayed in Mexico, intermarried, and over the generations, there are still extant descendants who now, for example, one of them has just written a new book on Joseph Lancaster. It's called Ricardo Antonio Lopez Portillo y Lancaster Jones.
Mm. So he has some success and legacy in Mexico. Where does he end up then?
Well, in 1827, he pretty much has to flee, almost, you would say, flee for his life from Venezuela, where, not entirely his own fault, obviously, South American politics, as ever, were pretty volatile and pretty much a civil war situation at the time. So he flees back off to, initially to Philadelphia, and then he sort of trawls around the United States and up to Canada, attempting to raise money, attempting to start new schools. But by this stage, he's run out of steam, run out of money, and run out of credit with any supporters that he may have had. So sadly, he drifts into obscurity. And in October 1838, he's standing on a street corner in New York City, and a tradesman has left his horse and carriage unattended. The horse is scared by something and bolts, rushes around the corner and runs poor Joseph over. And he dies of his injuries the following day. And by that stage, he was very, not really well remembered. A small memorial is set up to him in a local cemetery, but he died as he was born in humble, obscure circumstances.
Right.
Happily, his legacy and his ideas and his methods have very much outlived him and shown themselves to have merit. Lancasterian schools continued in vogue until around about the 1850s, and through the British and Foreign School Society, which carried on Lancaster's work, schools were set up all across the world.
So let's assume that you're listening to this and you're fascinated, Andy. Hopefully that will be the case somewhere. And you think, that'd be really good to see what this has done. But presumably it's impossible to visualise how his school would have looked or how his system would have been.
Almost impossible to visualise. Lancaster gave very specific instructions on how to build and operate a single schoolroom. Now, nowadays, we talk a lot about the benefits of reducing class sizes. Most of Joseph's ideas are quite innovative and forward-thinking, but not so much with class sizes, because he felt he had this system which could work quite mechanically, if you like, for up to 1,000 children in one space.
Oh, wow.
So his idea was to build these very large schoolrooms in which children, a master would, through using the monitors, could give a basic level of education to hundreds of children in one space. And he writes quite extensively on how this schoolroom should be built. It should be built on high ground, away from with good ventilation, away from the pollution of the town centres. The windows should be up high so that there's plenty of light, but the children don't get too hot in the summer. Even down to things like the corners of the desks should be rounded off so children don't bruise themselves when they're moving around the schoolroom. And we estimate that there were probably about 65 such schoolrooms built in Great Britain. And there were certainly others in South America, in North America, in the Caribbean, and in Scandinavia, where Lancaster's ideas were taken up quite early. And now there is just one Lancasterian schoolroom left anywhere in the world.
Gosh, how fantastic there's one left. Where would that be, Andy?
Well, funny enough, David, it's about half a mile from where I am at the moment, in, as you described it earlier, the golden city of Hitchin.
Right, fantastic.
In North Hertfordshire, on the King's Cross line from London, just 25 minutes from King's Cross, and about 5 minutes from the A1M, so very easy to get to. We have a wonderful website. It's www.britishschoolsmuseum.org.uk. And as we mentioned earlier, we have a wonderful new exhibition coming up in the middle of February.
Yeah, so you won a prize, didn't you?
We did, yes. Now, Joseph Lancaster's story, we find it very inspirational, and we try and spread it around far and wide. And happily, the good people at the Association of Independent Museums found it equally inspiring, and they agreed that he ought to be included in a pantheon of greats, shall we say, called their History Makers Programme. This is grant money from the AIM Biffer Recycling Scheme, which is channeled through the Association of Independent Museums, in this case, to put on exhibitions about notable people from British history who have, in their own way, changed the world in which we live in. And they agreed with us that Lancaster is one such history maker. So with a pretty substantial grant from that scheme, we've done a really quite a bold reinterpretation of the world's last remaining monitorial schoolroom, and really tried to find lots of different ways that people can come and visit and discover this extraordinary story for themselves. It is an amazing story. Lancaster's life itself would make a wonderful Hollywood blockbuster.
Yes.
And of course, his impact, the first generation of scholars from millions of families, can really trace their opportunity back to Lancaster's work. A really remarkable man, and I just hope this exhibition is a great success, because I do think Lancaster's story should be better known. The work that he did ought to make his memory fragrant to posterity, as was once said of him in the description of him as the poor child's friend, which is a pretty fine nickname to have, I'd say.
Well, I must admit, you took me around the museum a while ago. I absolutely loved going around. It was absolutely fascinating seeing how things used to work. So I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the new exhibition. When does the exhibition open?
It opens on the Friday the 15th of February. The museum is open to the public on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, or to groups by appointment in advance. All the details are on our website.
Brilliant. And that website again?
Thank you. Yes, it's www.britishschoolsmuseum.org.uk.
And there's an S on the end of schools, isn't there?
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yes. British schools. Our particular school was a boys' school, a girls' school and an infant school, hence the plural.
And you've got a Victorian schoolroom as well, don't you?
Yes, it's quite an extensive site. The oldest part of the school actually opened in 1810, but the original buildings are no more. So the oldest part is the schoolroom itself, Lancaster Schoolroom, which was built in 1837. There's a beautiful tiered gallery-style classroom of 1853. Girls and infant schools were 1857, along with houses in which the headmaster and the headmistress lived. And the headmaster's house has been restored to its late Victorian glory, a beautiful little sort of snapshot of Victorian domestic life. And then two further classrooms which were added in the early part of the 20th century, I think 1905, if memory serves. So four historic classrooms, headmaster's house, and lots of displays and exhibitions. And in fact, we've actually got two exhibitions opening on the same day. We've got the Joseph Lancaster exhibition, and running in parallel is a temporary exhibition called Stick and Carrot, which is about attitudes towards discipline.
Right.
Particularly in Victorian schools. I think most of our ideas of Victorian school discipline perhaps come from Dickens, who obviously didn't have a very good time at school.
No.
But we were fortunate enough to go to one of Lancaster's schools. Those are the ones where the pupils ran joyfully to school.
So. Well, maybe we wouldn't have had to put up with reading Our Mutual Friend and the Pickwick Papers and all that stuff. I feel slightly resentful. And one last thing, have I remembered wrongly that this wasn't built in the most salubrious bit of Hitchin? I seem to remember you telling me the name of the local road or something.
That's right, yes, indeed. I mean, the British schools very often were founded in the poorest parts. You mentioned the national schools earlier, and of course the Church of England had far greater resources, and if you see a beautiful Gothic Revival style village school, that's almost certainly a national school. The British schools are usually much more functional buildings built in the poorer parts of town, and in the case of Hitchin, would you believe it, if you visit today you'll find it a glorious little town, as you've said, but at that time there was a street called Dead Street, and it was known as the Dead Street School. It took its name from outbreak of the plague in 1349, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Dead Street for over 500 years. And in the late 1840s, of course, there were a lot of public health reports done across the country, and the Public Health Act was passed, which Hitchin did take up quite early, actually. So they cleaned up Dead Street a little bit. And in 1862, to cheer the residents up on the occasion of Queen Victoria's Silver Jubilee, they changed the name to Queen Street.
Right, there you go.
So if you are visiting by car, set the sat-nav for Queen Street and not for Dead Street.
Right, very good. Well, look, Andy, that's been really kind of you. Thank you very much, and best of luck with the exhibition.
Great, thanks very much indeed, David. Pleasure talking to you as ever.
Perfect.
Another organisation I should mention is the Brunel University Archives, who very kindly took over the British and Foreign School Society archives a few years ago. To find those, because there's loads of stuff, there's lots of minute books, pictures, lists of schools, lists of students, that kind of thing, go to the Brunel University website, www.brunel.ac.uk, and then search for BFSS. You can also go to a direct link on my website. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.